Hi, this is Eric Davis, and this is lecture three for the Maybe Logic Academy course, Gnosis Now. This week is the last week where we'll be looking at traditional, ancient Gnostic texts, and in some ways it's the chewiest piece that we've read yet, because unlike the other texts, which were gospels or collections of sayings, this is a cosmogony, a creation story, and is, as is often the case with the Gnostics, or generally the case, that these cosmogonies or cosmologies, structures of the universe, are very complicated, obscure, and very rich with characters and layers of reality, and so can be a bit tough on the head. I chose one to read called On the Origin of the World, but there are many in the Gnostic Bible, and they're quite fun to read. And really, the more you read of them, the more they start to make sense, because while they're each one is different, and there's always different details and different names, and sometimes figures are more good in one and become more not so good in another one, the basic patterns of the stories are rather similar. And so actually the more you read, the more it starts to kind of make sense. So the cosmogonies are really the creation stories are really the place where the Gnostics laid out their mythology, where they named their gods, they created the structure of reality, where they reflected the nature of all the entities that inhabited the world between our physical world and the world of the high god, of the far god, with his aeons. You don't get too much of the aeons in the text we reread this or we're reading this week, but that's an important idea, which is that along with the sort of highest supreme god, there's sort of a collection of other entities that maybe he's identified with, maybe not, but they tend to be things like his wisdom or his forethought or his omniscience. But they are their own kind of entities that are usually referred to as aeons. So when Aleister Crowley talks about the new aeon, in some sense he's drawing from this idea of a god who is also a kind of form of consciousness or a kind of layer of reality. But most of the action we see here takes place in a lower realm, and it begins with, and it's a little obscure in this one, it's a little clearer in some other Gnostic creation stories, where the Gnostics are facing the same problem that Christians face, or that other monomyths or monotheist kind of groups do, which is how do you explain the origin of evil, really one of the great problems in world religion, not just evil in terms of a conscious malevolent Satanism, but also just badness, things that go wrong, suffering and pain and death, etc. This problem is called theodicy, and the Gnostics had their own twist on it. And they often explained it in this way that you see here, where it's through a kind of frustrated desire from one of the beings in the supreme world, sort of kind of getting out of line and seeking to unite too quickly or too intensely with the Father. So it has that kind of erotic overtone, and it is often the figure Sophia, who appears in complicated and somewhat contradictory ways, is multiplied actually in the text that we read. And I'll mention that a little bit more in a second. But the idea is often that Sophia, out of her great desire to unite with the Father, sort of seeks to do it and kind of breaks the chain of command. And is frustrated and forced out of the higher realm because of this action, or the emotions, or the psychic energies that have been produced by this action coalesce into the material world. And so, in some accounts, the suffering and the pain and the longing and the grief that exist in our realm are partly Sophia's emotions that are bound up in this, what is sometimes called pleasantly, an abortion of matter. So it's almost a kind of a stillbirth or an abortion from out of her desire. There's a little hint of that at the beginning of On the Origin of the World. But what we do get is a nice picture of Yaldabaoth, I think that's how you pronounce it, which is one of the names for the blind, ignorant, and to some extent malevolent god, who is, as we can tell from here, more or less identified with the god of the Old Testament. Right here we have one of those primal Gnostic ideas that is so, funny in its kind of table-turning on the traditional story, where in the traditional Bible, with the Old and New Testament, the God of the New Testament, the God of Jesus, is the same God as the God of the Old Testament, even though he acts like a pretty different God. The God of the Old Testament is clearly like sort of irascible, cranky, sometimes, extremely violent, jealous character, fairly different from the one that we get in the New Testament. But the basic sort of mythos of the Bible is that this is one God. Whereas the Gnostics turned this on their head, and or at least some Gnostics did, many Gnostics did, and said that the God of the Old Testament, the God we meet in Genesis, the God who expels Adam and Eve from the garden, is in fact not the true God, but is a lower order of being, perhaps malevolent and perhaps simply ignorant. And here we have sort of a depiction of the creation of this this being, this master of matter, who in some sense is an offspring of this Sophia figure, who has kind of caused this calamity in heaven and created a sort of space in the cosmos that is outside of the boundaries of the light realm, outside the boundaries of the true God, and so one of the things that defines Yaldabaoth is that, or as this character is often known as Samael, which is the blind god. Is that he believes he's the only thing around. So it's almost as if once this abortion of matter or this error has been separated from the high god, then any beings who emerge in that world have no idea about this other realm unless they're specifically contacted or somehow see through the veil of their realm. And our demiurge, which is a Greek word that means maker, and Plato's creation myths, which also influence Gnostic ones, use the term demiurge. But our demiurge here is kind of a bumbler, or kind of a fool, or kind of an arrogant idiot. And we're under his reign in some sense, his and his minions, the famous archons. And that's something else we meet early on in the text, is this kind of elaboration of these various powers, or as they're often called in this particular text, authorities, but they all mean the same thing, the archons, the rulers of the world, the rulers of our reality, our physical reality, but also to some extent our psychic reality or our mythic reality. As we've already kind of noticed from some comments in last week's thread, the archons are one of the more fascinating elements of the Gnostic cosmology, because while you can sort of show their relationship to the idea of demons, they're really kind of different characters. They do have a fallen angel quality to them. They are sort of angelic in the sense that they administer different realms of reality, and they exist in a kind of hierarchy that moves through the heavens. In a chapter in Richard Smalley's book that I didn't assign, but I had just been reading, he talked about the way that our now traditional idea of angels as living in a kind of hierarchy of nine levels of the celestial heavens, the cherubim and the principalities and the powers and the angels and the archangels and the et cetera, seraphim, I don't know them all, but that this basic idea of a stacked hierarchy of powers really descends or evolves from a more malevolent or dark view of these hierarchies of power in the Gnostic cosmologies. You'll see also in the Cugliano reading this week, which is a very fascinating reading about what he calls the Platonic space shuttle. And he talks about how the idea of a hierarchy of powers it relates to a model that most of us are going to be more familiar with through astrology. The idea in one way of describing astrology is that the the different planets are basically gods, and they sort of rule that sort of territory of life or reality or the material world. And they rule it to even the extent of controlling it. These days, we don't have a very fatalistic idea within Western astrology. Usually, it's a read very psychologically. So these are about forces inside the self that we can really work through, and it's not a deterministic thing like you're going to die on Tuesday, or you're going to get cancer of the stomach, or you know, some nasty fate handed down from the perpetual machinery of karma. But this is really more the way astrology was traditionally understood, that the powers that ruled the heavens, the stars moving through the heavens, were gods who lived in these different layers, so that there was a layer of the moon, and then after that you have the layer of Mercury, and then the layer of Venus, and the layer of the sun, and it would go through these different layers. In the Cugliano piece, you'll see that this ended up influencing people's ideas about what birth and what the afterlife was like, because in some Platonic models that very much influence Gnosticism, there's the idea that we descend from the high realm into the earth, and as we descend into birth, we pass through these different heavens, and these different archons sort of shape us and weave the tapestry of fate and to some extent our personality into us as we descend. So if you're born under the sign of Saturn, you're going to be kind of a melancholic, depressive, mopey guy, because on the way down, Saturn was able to kind of, you know, put his mark on you, put his stamp on you. And simultaneously, when we die, we ascend through these different layers of reality, and it's this arduous journey where the Gnostic or the spiritual, transcendent aiming person must go through and confront these various nasty folks and either have the secret signs or the magic words, or as it was also brought up in the thread last week, perhaps you can be invisible and they just don't notice you as you head towards the heavens. You can see if you read On the Origin of the World closely that it's not like the archons are exactly identified with the planetary powers. The numbers of them are a little confusing. I read this text a number of times and I'm still kind of confused of whether there's six heavens or seven heavens or eight heavens. And usually the idea that there's seven heavens and then the eighth heaven is the kind of heaven of the stars that don't move. The lower stars, the planets, which is what they would think of them as, is moving stars. They move, but then once you get to the eighth heaven, it's all static because it's perfect and nothing changes, and that would be the realm of the higher god, or at least the realm before you get to the realm of the higher god. So while we can't strictly identify the archons with the astrological powers, it's actually a really good metaphor because we already kind of have a sense of who the astrological planets are and their relationship to fate, their relationship to necessity, particularly in the older pre-Jungian views of astrology, where you were really sort of at their whim, and that many of the events in your life were completely fated based on the time of your birth or based on the any number of other ways in which the astrological powers controlled us. So it's a very interesting model because, unlike demons, who are largely seen as kind of like, you know, doing feisty, nasty things, or purely sort of subvertive, negative force, the archons kind of have power. They're sort of an administrative, even bureaucratic kind of energy. And so there's lots of metaphoric room that I'm sure we're going to explore this week and in the coming weeks, because many of the readings that I chose for that are more modern readings really play with this idea of the archons, particularly the William S. Burroughs a short bit. You'll see very much how Burroughs was reinterpreting, or at least responding to, a similar kind of view of reality. But I always thought the fact that there's some kind of administrative function into the archons, a very powerful metaphor for our modern life. You know, it's like when you get, you know, stuck in some kind of bureaucratic wrangle with the phone company. I always feel like I'm sort of like under the thumb of the archons who rule the the communication sphere. And in many ways, corporations or the sort of spirit of corporations or whatever that sense of entity that corporations possess, for me, often feel like a kind of archon where it's like they do some useful things, they have their power, but ultimately not really in our best interests. So anyway, once the archons get set up, we have this gradual multi-layered cosmogony or creation story that is clearly based and frankly parodies the traditional account in Genesis. This is one of the marvelous things about Gnostic writings that make him seem so fresh and modern to our ears, is that we can see the way in which they are consciously responding to and even subverting previously existing texts. So there's a textuality, a consciousness about writing and the nature of text and how text creates reality or creates mythology that they're very much working with, where they actually want to mock the God who in other readings or in other texts is seen as the true God. So there's a lot of commentary and mimicry and parody of the traditional Genesis account on the origin of the world. And if you've read Genesis at all, you'll recognize a number of these lines and ideas. Probably the most radical of these is the notion that the beast or the snake, the one who encourages Eve and therefore Adam to eat of the knowledge of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, is actually the instructor, is actually the guy who's trying to get them out of the garden. Because, of course, if you look at the God of the Garden of Paradise in the Old Testament as being an evil, or at the very least a bumbling, ignorant God, then anything that's going to wake up these poor folks is going to be on the side of light. There's an additional complexity, if this isn't already complex enough, which is that there's often a lot of mirroring and copying inside of these Gnostic creation stories. And it's particularly the copying that again seems weirdly modern to me. I always think of the simulacrum or these sort of parody objects inside Philip K. Dick books, but maybe that's because I discovered Gnosticism through Philip K. Dick. But we see that in a couple of ways in this text. One of these mirrorings is, again, the complexity of the Sophia figure. The higher or good Sophia, who is going to intervene in the abortion of matter in order to liberate the human spirit, is Pistis Sophia. And she has a daughter, Zoe, which means life, or Zoe Sophia, or Sophia Zoe. But there's also a lower Sophia who is one of the archons, or the female side of these archons, who I should have mentioned are androgynous, which itself is kind of an interesting thing. The whole relationship of androgyny and gender is incredibly rich in this creation story, as it is in throughout Gnostic literature, and I hope we can go into that more in the threads as well. But in another one of these sort of complex mirrorings or echoes is the nature of Adam. In the text, there's clearly two Adams. There is the heavenly Adam, who is the sort of cosmic man. And the cosmic man is an idea in the realm of the good entities, in the realm of the light entities. Indeed, it's a kind of an archetype of humankind. And you find this idea very much in Kabbalism as well, with the idea of the Adam Kadmon, who's the kind of cosmic man, who's sometimes seen as the body of the universe itself, is this kind of realized higher human, and sometimes an androgynous figure as well. Sometimes Adam Kadmon is actually considered to be not a man, but a man-woman. But that this figure then is copied by the archons. There's a lot of copying by the archons, where they see an image of something high. They see an image of Sophia, or they see an image of the higher Adam. And then they, using their lower, tawdry, kind of cut-rate tools, create a copy of these things for various reasons. In the case of Adam, is to actually kind of trap the spirits, to make them feel like that this is the true guy when he's really essentially a zombie. And so it's quite complicated because their very attempt to create a false Adam as a way to trick others it turns out to be that they were tricked, really, because by setting in motion the human race, they were creating the vessels that would allow this liberating energy to come in from the higher forces and ultimately redeem creation. Again, it's a complicated story, and I don't want to go in and try to parse every bit of it because the details always change in different accounts. But that's more or less the story. So you have this marvelous idea of Adam as being this kind of zombie or a golem who is brought to life by this breath from Sophia. So Sophia, the female figure, is really the mediator, almost like a Holy Spirit kind of figure. It is Sophia who is both sort of our realm and still above the realm, and it is she who communicates the liberating energy. She's sort of like a higher Jesus in a way, or at least the pre-Jesus, that just as Jesus actually comes into the world in these Gnostic myths and allows this kind of salvational energy or kind of route or a teaching that allows an escape back into the higher realm. The Sophia kind of sets in motion this interaction between the higher and the lower realm. And so she's the one who enlivens the Adam. Another interesting thing on this sort of gender point is the way that Eve is clearly a more evolved, higher and richer being in her creation than Adam. It is Adam who's kind of this bumbling zombie, but Eve from the get-go is this expression of the higher realm inside of the world. And indeed, she at one point seems to actually become the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So it's a very profound idea of the role of Eve, who again kind of mirrors or echoes Sophia in her world bridging and her ability to bring higher wisdom down into this kind of lost wilderness. And when the archons are trying to trick Adam into believing that Eve came out of him, again a parody of the Genesis account of the creation of Eve from Adam's rib. In this account, it's clear that that's a myth, and that if you believe that story, it's only because you bought the disinformation, you bought the lie. In a way, the Gnostics are kind of like conspiracy theorists, where they say, "Oh, all the mainstream people believe the dupe story that a bunch of Arab terrorists caused 9/11, but we have the real deal, and we'll show you what was actually going on." And in a way, there's something to that energy. To these accounts, and one of the ways they're trying to trick Adam is to not only think that Eve was made from him, but to therefore treat her as a slave. And it says that explicitly, treat her as a slave, so that their proper relationship is actually an inverted one, where Eve is really has more spiritual juju than this lower Adam, who is in essence a kind of simulacrum. So that's a sort of fascinating tension there as well. So, you know, from all of these accounts, we really get a sense of the kind of dynamism and creative imagination that was going on inside the Gnostics. The fact that each group or sect seemed to produce their own sort of creation story has often been sort of seen as a kind of example of the wild and wacky side of the movement, that it's like they can never really settle on anything. It's like each new guy comes along and comes up with a new system. But from our side, where we are approaching these stories largely as myths with potentially psychological meaning and archetypal meaning and possibly some genuine spiritual, you know, cosmological mirrorings as well, but the creativity and the tension and the richness and the self-referentiality of these texts make them much more alive, at least for me, than the standard account, which is kind of like the old war horse, whereas this is the postmodern remix with a lot more energy, a little bit more crazy, a little bit harder to follow, like a Japanese anime or something like that, but a lot more imaginatively engaged and imaginatively rich. I wanted to read one little bit at the end there about how this in a section called The Blessed Innocent Spirits, and it's just towards the very end. And this, although it's not really clear how this relates to the narrative that we've just read, because it's kind of a slightly different account, at least as I read it, it gives us this fundamental idea about the relationship of spirit and body, or especially the human body, which is that the human body itself is kind of a product of this archonic simulacrum, copying sort of parody of the true high heavenly human body. And so we carry these kind of leaky contraptions, and yet the light has gotten into these. And the light, whether it's brought by Sophia or in this case by these blessed innocent spirits, has sort of entered into us. It's almost like the idea of walk-ins in UFO lore, where people you'll meet people who claim that actually they're aliens and who have just sort of entered into a human body and kind of temporarily or permanently asked the human resident to leave. It has that quality to it because the difference between the higher and lower realm is so crisply defined in so many Gnostic accounts. So they're talking about the when the when the blessed ones appeared in the fashion bodies of the authorities, meaning the fashion bodies of the archons, they were envied. And this is often the motivating factor in a lot of the cosmogonies is envy. The lower figures see the higher figures and they want their beauty or they want their bodies, and so they act in relationship to that. Because of envy, the authorities or the archons mixed their seed with them to defile them, but they were not able to. Moreover, when the blessed ones appeared in their light, they appeared distinctively, and each one of them from the land from their land revealed their knowledge to the assembly that appeared in the fashioned bodies of destruction. That means us. The assembly was found to have every seed because of the seed of the authorities that was mixed in it. Then the Savior made all of them one. So there's this idea that, oh, and one more line, and the spirits of these appeared, being superior and blessed, but varying in election, and many others are kingless and superior to everyone who was before them. And this is this amazing idea that they talk about how there's four races, four different combinations of these lower bodies and these higher spirits. There's the three levels that we talked about last week: the level of the body, the level of the soul, and the level of the spirit. And it's this tripartite hierarchy that's carried through a lot of Gnostic texts. But here they talk about the fourth race is kingless and perfect. And I don't know if kingless is a phrase you encounter very often in Near Eastern texts. This is the first time I've really noticed it. But it seems like a remarkable way to acknowledge this sense of freedom or liberation that's at the core of the Gnostic project, and which makes it much more interesting than just a body-hating, world-hating religion of asceticism. That there's this really intense sense that all of us below that are under the kings. We are following the archons. However much we may struggle, we always need to pay our pound of flesh to all of these different kings, these different powers. But that the truly liberated Gnostic is kingless, is free. One might almost say a nomad.